Welcome to the podcast, Tis But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction about the Middle Ages. I'm your host, Professor Richard Abels. Today's episode is about Jerusalem in the 12th century, when the city was the capital of a Crusader kingdom. My very special guest for this episode is Dr. John Hostler. John is one of the very best and most prolific military historians of the Crusades. He is the author of four books: Henry II, A Medieval Soldier at War, 1147 to 1189, John of Salisbury, Military Authority of the 12th Century Renaissance, The Siege of Acre, 1189 to 1191, Saladin, Richard the Lionheart, and the Battle That Decided the Third Crusade, which was a Times Literary Supplement book for the year 2018. And most recently, Jerusalem Falls, Seven Centuries of War and Peace, published by Yale University Press in 2022. John is also the author of more than 50 articles, and he has either edited or co-edited three volumes of scholarly essays. Now, one of those volumes is especially near and dear to me. I'll read off the title and let you guess why. Military Cultures and Martial Enterprises in the Middle Ages, Essays in Honor of Richard P. Abels. Edited by John D. Hostler and Stephen Isaac. It's what academics call a Festschrift, a volume of essays celebrating the career of a scholar presented upon his or her retirement. The essays are usually by former graduate students, as I spent my entire career as an undergraduate teacher at the U.S. Naval Academy. The essays in this volume are by my colleagues in the field of medieval military history. John, I really wanted to thank you and Stephen for organizing and editing this volume. It was a completely unexpected honor and one of the high points of my career as a scholar. Thank you.
It was my pleasure, and I'm sure Stephen, my co-editor, would say the same thing.
Along with our friend and colleague Cliff Rogers at West Point, John and I share the rather odd distinction of being medieval historians who teach, or in my case, taught, U.S. military officers. Whereas I taught future Navy and Marine Corps officers, John teaches military history to field-grade Army officers, mainly majors, at the Army's Command and General Staff College in Leavenworth, Kansas. This is probably a career path that neither of us expected when we were in graduate school. John, would you like to talk a little bit about your experience teaching military history to career soldiers?
Sure. It surprises me sometimes that I'm here. At CGSC, as we call it, it's primarily we get captain promotables and majors. And if they're captain promotable, they're a major by the time they leave. And we teach them a lot of coursework that they're going to need in their next jobs as they enter field grade work. And that involves a lot of things you'd think the Army would be teaching to people, such as tactics, logistics, leadership. And then, you know, part of it is a course in military history. All year long, they study military history. Now and when I took the job, I understood this. It's modern military history. We start with Napoleon, and we go all the way until, this year we went to Operation Iraqi Freedom. But during the elective period, I get to teach courses on medieval warfare. So I'm teaching one right now on medieval Western warfare. And then in May, I'll teach my elective on crusading warfare. And those classes have filled. They're at the max because people are interested in these things, and particularly the crusading class, which every year has proved popular simply because of what goes on in CENTCOM, especially most recently in that area of the world. So it's interesting. And then also, we really do applied history here. It's which I think is a great thing. How does study of the past provide the leaders of today and tomorrow? How does it help inform their military judgment? How does it make them better, agile, and adaptive leaders when they're downrange and a situation pops up and they haven't seen it before and they have to think critically about this? And if they can remember, I'm not the first person to confront a situation like this. and I know something about how other commanders have met these challenges, and it helps inform them.
I accept the importance of military history brought to our military officers. So it's justified my career, and it's justified your career. That's great.
I hope so, yes.
It is.
But we should turn to the subject of today's episode, Jerusalem in the 12th century. What Jerusalem meant to the Christians, Muslims, and Jews of the crusading era. We actually have a cinematic answer to that question given in Ridley Scott's epic, The Kingdom of Heaven. Having negotiated the surrender of Jerusalem to Saladin after a fierce defense of the city, the film's protagonist, Balian, turns to Saladin and asks,
"What is Jerusalem worth?"
"Nothing. Everything."
Well, I think that says it all. I mean, yeah. If you're looking at a movie that gets the Middle Ages completely wrong, it's Kingdom of Heaven.
Yeah, it's got some problems. Two years ago, I gave a talk here on Kingdom of Heaven at the Kansas City Public Library. I think we got 200 people or something, you know, and it was fascinating to, you know, people it's something that everybody's seen. And everybody was very quick to tell me, they said, "Well, it may be bad, but have you seen the director's cut?" That's what they all wanted to know. "Have you seen the director's cut? Is much better.
Much better." Yeah.
You see the director's cut and you say, no.
Well, I think we'll be able to expand a little bit on Saladin's answer in this episode.
Yeah.
Now, when I looked over your career, and I've known you from the time that you were a graduate student.
I was thinking about this morning. I think we first met, it was either 2000 or 2001 at a conference, I think.
It was at the conference. I remember that.
Yeah. So long time. So, well, 24 years or so.
Oh, my God.
I guess I was wrapping up my master's and going into my doctorate.
Back then, you were a budding military historian of Angevin England. But in more recent years, the focus of your work has shifted from warfare in 12th century Western Europe to crusading warfare, and most recently, to the role of Jerusalem in the thought and politics of the medieval Middle East. What led you to explore the Crusades? What explains this shift in your scholarly focus?
Well, I think it's, you know, so much of it is based on who are your professors? You know, what are your influences? I wrote my dissertation on the warfare of Henry II. My dissertation advisor was Daniel Callahan at the University of Delaware, who was not a military historian. You know, he studied apocalypticism, heresy, anti-Judaism, and, you know, and sort of these religious movements in 11th century France. And in particular, he studied the monk Adhemar of Chabannes, who was very famous for writing about Jerusalem and the end of the world.
Right.
And so I remember Dan had a map of Jerusalem, the city, on the back of his wall. And I looked at it every time I went into his office to talk to him. You're looking at Jerusalem. And he would always say in class, he would kind of a riff on the American exceptionalism bit of the westward expansion. He would say, instead of "go west, young man," he would say, "go east, young man, go east." And he would say, you know, "someday you're going to look at Jerusalem someday." And I'm like, no. I care about the Angevins. I care about the West. And no. Well, as it turns out, after I studied Henry and John of Salisbury, one of the major sources for Henry's reign, I ended up getting into Richard the Lionheart, and I followed Richard the Lionheart east. You know, here go the Angevins on crusade. And that takes you into the Middle East. And all of a sudden, I'm looking at sources that my advisor had told me about, that we had talked about in his classes, that I had kind of always, you know, put over there for teaching. And I, you know, I would teach the Crusades and it was interesting. And then I found myself plunging into it. And so I shouldn't have been as surprised as I was. But I hope Dan just passed away a couple months ago. I hope he was proud of me for finally making that shift. And so now I have my feet sort of in both worlds, because I'm still interested in the Angevins. And I do have some work on John of Salisbury that's kind of been percolating, and some other things I'm looking at in the West. But I'm increasingly drawn to Near Eastern warfare. What really struck me about it, something that I didn't find in when you study Western warfare, the ability to take a corpus of Christian sources, you know, Latin, Greek, right. Italian, these sources here, and then Arabic sources talking about the same thing and being able to compare and contrast them to each other. I just find incredibly fascinating, particularly when you're talking about things like battles and sieges, where, you know, and then we courageously charged the wall and we lost 2,000 soldiers and the ladders were set on fire. And then you read the Arabic account and it's nothing like that. And you say, what is going on? And then from the side, you have, you know, you have the Byzantines kind of chirping in from the side with a different view altogether. And then sometimes you've got in the surviving Hebrew work, sometimes you got a Jewish picture from this other side, you know, this other party that's caught in the crosshairs. And I really enjoy that compare and contrast between the different perspectives. And you don't always get that in the West. I mean, you do, but the perspective is, well, okay, this person's writing in Normandy, this person's writing in East Anglia. Okay, you know, that's interesting, but the starkness of those different views, I really enjoy that. And if for a historian trying to get to, as I'm kind of an old fogey, I do think history is kind of the search for truth. That I think it's such a fascinating method to be able to say, here's what one people believe, here's what another people believe, and where is the truth? It's somewhere in here, and I'm going to try to get to it.
That reminds me of an episode that Ellen and I did almost 2 years ago. The episode was called How Saladin Took Jerusalem, Two Eyewitness Accounts and a Movie. The movie was, of course, Kingdom of Heaven, and I need say no more about that. The two eyewitness accounts were by Balian of Iblin's squire Inul and Saladin's chancellor Imad ad-Din al-Isfahani. Both men were not only present during the siege, but were well positioned to know about the high-level negotiations that led to the surrender. Mm-hmm. Although the accounts generally agree about what happened, they differ significantly in terms of tone and specifics, especially on why Saladin accepted Balian's offer of surrender.
One of the events that starkly illustrates the point that you're making is the massacre of 1099. If you read the Latin sources, you get the sense that they killed all the Jews. The entire Jewish population of Jerusalem had been slaughtered in this great apocalyptic massacre. And then you discover that from Hebrew sources that you have refugees who go down to Cairo.
Yeah.
So it's not, if you just simply take the Latin sources, you're not getting the picture.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's start with Jerusalem on the eve of the First Crusade in 1097.
Okay.
At this point, Jerusalem is in the hands of the Turks, right? It's been for a while in the hands of the Fatimid Caliphate. And now it's in the Turkish, it's under the Seljuks. What is Jerusalem to the Seljuks? What is Jerusalem at this point to the Fatimids? What does it mean, Jerusalem?
Yeah, it's a great question, because the, you know, the Fatimids have it until about 1073. So you're talking, you know, 26 years before the First Crusade arrives.
Right.
And they lose it to the Turks. And, you know, it's taken, from what I can discern, relatively peaceful. There's a blockade. There isn't much fighting. It kind of turns over and doesn't make a lot of noise in the sources that we have. It's almost a, if you did this turnover from some, if we want to say Sunni to Shia control, right? It's a whisper. It's an event, but there's no massacres. There's no mass suffering and things. Well, at least for a few years, until it turns out that there's a revolt in the city by some of the Shia, and they grab this Turkish general's family members and they throw him in prison. And he comes back in 1077 and kills.
And then there is a massacre.
And then there is a massacre. He kills 3,000 people, which is the same number you have reported for 1099. It's the same number.
But you don't get that in the textbooks.
No, they skip right over it. And there has been some study of this lately about, you know, well, how good are the sources and how can we take this and what are the reasons? But one thing I pointed out in the book is I said, you know, I don't know, are these lives more or less precious than the ones later on? I mean, this, I think it doesn't have the same drama that the other does. It's religious, it's interreligious warfare, but the sources are light they are like, you do not have these elaborate descriptions that you have in the Crusader Chronicles. You have so many of them and in such colorful language. It's very terse chronicle entries that they're very factual. There's one poem written about it later, but you don't have a lot of description. So I think it's as an event, it just kind of passes over and it takes second fiddle to what's perceived to be much more dramatic later on. And sometimes you're stuck with this as a historian. You just say, well, you know, if we don't have the colorful accounts, it's like 1099. We don't have a primary Arabic account of that siege. It would be undoubtedly fascinating if we did. You know, what are they thinking about this? So you're kind of stuck with the materials you have. But in any case, you end up with a city that you might imagine is a little disquieted. These seem to be, I would argue, more or less targeted killings. Seems to be like exactly the perpetrators are sorted out and specifically found. They retreat to the Dome of the Rock and take refuge. They're besieged in it and they're slaughtered inside. It's almost like Atsiz, the man who does this, the general, knows exactly who he's going after, and it's direct revenge and payback. And the rest of the city is spared. You don't have destruction of mosques and buildings and that sort of thing. And then after 1077, there's kind of been an argument about this. There was an old assumption that following this, there was mass persecution of Christians, and that life got really tough in Jerusalem over those last couple of decades. Pilgrimage became very difficult to pull off to get to the city. More recent studies are really casting some doubt on that and finding that actually things were kind of returned to normal, in which you have, there's Christians there, Eastern Christians, there's Jews, there's Muslims, there's some Shia Sunni bad blood, of course, but that people were grudgingly kind of living next to each other and eking out what they could in a bit of a tense environment. And that's really what Jerusalem is sort of like when the Crusade departs from Western Europe.
Although the Crusaders think that Christians are being persecuted,
yes,
and that Christians are being prevented from going to Jerusalem. Is this Byzantine propaganda in the being spread through the West?
Well, and that's right. As I'm sure you know, that's a huge question, right? I mean, Urban's sermon and the versions of it we have. How much of this is actually happening? How much of this is information that the Byzantine emperor is pushing out to the West? You know, how much of it is reality? I think there's quite a bit of embellishment. I mean, some of those sermons are really, I mean, they almost, you know, they're pretty disgusting in their descriptions of what is happening to local Christians.
What is supposed to be happening, yeah.
Yeah. And what I found is some of that is happening. My question just was writing the book is how much of that is happening in Jerusalem specifically?
Right.
And that's kind of one thing I found through writing this is that Jerusalem almost stands as kind of a curious exception in a lot of ways. You know, when the Crusaders take the city, they expel all the Jews from the city, right? They don't do that anywhere else. It's the only major town that they expel the Jews and Muslims from. The rest of them, they sort of leave alone. Why is that? Is Jerusalem a place where life was kind of okay in the 1070s and 1080s, whereas in Caesarea and Tyre and these other places, maybe life is a lot grittier, a lot trickier.
Right.
But that's a, you know, that'll be endlessly argued over. You know, is Urban telling the truth? Is he propagandizing? Is he embellishing? Does he need to embellish to get people to sign up? And that's all, you know, going through yet another round of scrutiny, although I kind of see this, like a lot of things in the Crusades, as just a cycle. We're going to keep talking about them over and over. I don't know that new ground will ever be broken on it.
But the really weird thing to me is that Urban II sermons and the preaching of the First Crusade make it sound as if Jerusalem has just been captured by the Muslim, and it's been in Muslim hands since what, 638?
638, yeah.
Yeah, so it's nothing new about this.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, this has become a real cause in the West.
Well, it really had. You know, the 11th century is, I mentioned my doctoral advisor earlier. One of the last times I talked to him, he was telling me about, he said, I've really been interested in the 13th century lately. I said, oh, really? You're getting further in the period. But then he looked at me and he had stern eyes and he says, but you cannot forget the 11th century. You cannot forget it. So important. So important. And, you know, for Jerusalem, you know, it kicks off in 1009. Al-Hakim unleashes his forces and the Sepulchre Church is destroyed. You know, it's rebuilt and then it's destroyed again. You have the German pilgrimage in which, you know, these people get caught out in the open trying to get to the city and they're cut down in mass numbers. There is the, after the 1009 attack, there is this, I guess it's still unresolved question about whether Pope Sergius IV gets this information and tries to call a crusade, you know, at the start of the 11th century, blaming things on the local Jews. And, oh, well, you know, they have ratted out the Christians and we need to go and get our revenge. And Pope Gregory VII, by the time you're in the 1070s, he's trying to plan a crusade. So it's strange. Yeah, you're absolutely right. These things, that the Muslims have been around for hundreds of years. But there seemed to have been this immediacy in the 11th century that things were starting to get so bad in the Western imagination. Somebody has to do something.
And also in the Western imagination, it's an apocalyptic period.
Yes.
And the idea is we're coming to the end of time.
Yes.
And that means Jerusalem is at the center.
Yeah. And, some crusade historians like Jay Rubenstein have really sort of emphasized that apocalyptic angle that you see in the Chronicles, right? That we're going to witness the return of Jesus and the descent of the heavenly Jerusalem.
The massacres portrayed through the book of Revelation.
Yes. Yep.
Which is, you know, the really shocking thing about it is not so much that they massacred, but the triumphant tone that's taken by the eyewitness accounts of the massacre. But the tone is the book of Revelation. Right. It's tramping out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored.
That's right. And the reference to the ankle, knee, bridle high blood on the temple.
Right out of the Bible.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think it's so many of these things are coming together at once. And there's this sort of immediacy that, you know, this is our moment in history. We're going to see through the greatest change, which if you're thinking in terms of salvation history, you are at the climax. This is the most important thing that has happened or will happen since the crucifixion. And the thought of being there for that. And then you layer on all these other things. And did you hear what they're doing? I didn't hear that. And did you hear about this? Whoa. And, you know, and I try to put myself in the mind of somebody who's, you know, in the West, who is not reading Eastern chronicles and letters and documents and knowing what's really going on. This is 3,000 kilometers away, right? And you hear tell of all of this stuff going on. It all seems like the history has been driving you to this moment. It must have been a very powerful feeling, I suppose.
It had to be. To move that many people out of, you go 1,500 kilometers of traveling for people who would hardly move 10 kilometers in their lifetime before that. That is a powerful driving force.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not completely surprising because Jerusalem is an idea in the West. It's the heavenly city made concrete.
Yes.
What is it? And I know this is a really controversial question. What is it in Islamic thought in the 11th century?
Great question. And this has been, from my impression, intense discussion on this in recent years, because it's, you know, Jerusalem has its meaning based off the night journey of Muhammad, right? I mean, that's where it begins. It is the direction of the first Qibla. Early Muslims would pray towards Jerusalem, right? Until that's changed and they begin to pray towards Mecca. And so clearly there is an importance to it. But the Arabists have really been going over in the past few years the nature of that importance, because it was never made a political capital by any of the caliphates, even though folks like the Umayyad, you know, would receive their titles in Jerusalem. They never made it their capital.
But they rule in Damascus, though.
Yeah, they rule from Damascus, and then the Abbasids would rule from Baghdad and other places. The Abbasids kind of moved around a little bit. So it's not a political importance particularly. It has a religious importance, but once the Qibla direction is changed towards Mecca, it's very unclear, well, what spiritual importance? Umar builds a mosque there on the Temple Mount, the first Al-Aqsa. Right. It's hallowed ground because Muhammad purportedly stood there, so it's got an importance. One thing I explore in the book is, we mentioned apocalypticism. There is, if you look at the end time story for Islam, it is the Golden Gate. It's the Temple Mount. It's the Dome of the Chain. It's the site for that. And Umar apparently asks about the Golden Gate on his way to the city. So, and that idea of the apocalyptic expectation has particularly been sort of addressed. And from what I gather, the Quranic scholars, historians who have been looking at the Quran are saying, you know, that theme of apocalypticism, there are some who argue it's as strong in the Quran as the theme of submission. And that's that one I don't even touch. I say, well, that's very interesting to me, but I'm not going to get into what the major themes of the Quran are, right? That is beyond my pay grade. So it seems to be that there is importance placed on it. But that said, for the first four centuries, it is not the focal point of Islamic worship, certainly I think even the Islamic imagination. It doesn't seem to be there, but it rather grows over time and starts to mature. Once you get into the 900s, it starts to take on more and more of a theological place.
Yes.
So by the time you get to the 12th century, once you have 1099 and the loss of Jerusalem, which, as I mentioned, the earlier conquest of Jerusalem, this would be the, in 638, in the 970s when the Fatimids take the town, and then in the 1070s when the Turks come. Not much more than whispers after the Muslims have the city. The first one is obviously talked about a lot because it's a big deal. But it's just, it changed hands. I mean, for the 970s, good luck even finding descriptive sources of the Shia coming. I mean, it's hardly a whisper in the sources. But 1099, wow. I mean, after that, there is this watershed, you know, change where all of a sudden it becomes uber important. Saladin is tasked, as Nur al-Din had been tasked before him, with, you know, you have some major jobs to do. You are supposed to unify Islam and you are to recover the holy city. And there's some real interesting Arabic poetry written at the time. It's this great book put out called The Cutting Edge of the Poet's Sword.
Oh, yeah.
Where just the theme, the drumbeat of you need to get Jerusalem back. And in Saladin's campaigns, he's routinely questioned by people. This is great that we're taking this port city. When are we going to Jerusalem? And there is a line. I know it's easy to make fun of Kingdom of Heaven. There is a line in that movie where one of Saladin's emirs does pose this point to him and says, you know, you're talking about all of this, but when are we going to Jerusalem? And so the pressure is on. So it's clearly, I would say, from the 10th into the 12th century, there is this change where it starts to take on much more importance than it had in early Islam.
One of the nice ironies is that Saladin's getting the same sort of drumbeat that Richard is going to get. It's really nice that you've taken all these coastal cities back, but when are we going to go to Jerusalem?
Yep, exactly. And from the, you know, from a strategic perspective, it's interesting when you have two generals, Richard and Saladin, who are very competent and have very good strategic plans. And the pressure on them to, in a sense, abandon good strategy to take a target that is symbolic, spiritual, and deeply meaningful, but has very little military.
Of no strategic significance and of no real economic or administrative importance.
Yep.
It's 60 miles inland, which makes it extremely difficult if you're being supplied from the sea to be able to have the logistical support for a siege that's going to be successful. Richard is absolutely right that if you're going to take Jerusalem, the way to take Jerusalem is to go to Cairo,
not to
go to Jerusalem. Saladin is very methodical about taking Jerusalem. One of the things that I noticed about Saladin taking Jerusalem is that he enters Jerusalem on the day celebrating Muhammad's accession to heaven. That seems to me to be too much of a coincidence. I think there's planning going on, and I think that there's a deal made with Balian and the defenders of the city to surrender the city exactly at the right time.
Mm-hmm. If you read Jonathan Phillips' book on Saladin, which is just terrific, he is clearly a political master. He knows exactly what things to say, when to time his movements, what gifts to give to the right people at the right time to make the correct impression. And so, yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, everything is calculated in a sense, and you can tell when when events turn against his calculations, when he's got things planned out and then friction happens, to pull in Clausewitz here, and then friction occurs and he doesn't get to you, his frustration is palpable in the sources. This is a planner. This is somebody who wants things going the way he foresees them. And he sets it up for like that. So, and that, you know, frankly, that realization, I would argue, would be a way to read his career. When some people look at Saladin, who, as you know, has been valorized, you know, across centuries, in the West as well as the East. If this is a man who plans everything and is that calculated, then everything he does, you can look through that lens. And sometimes when he gets himself into scrapes that don't support the legend, right? One of them in particular at the Siege of Jerusalem, people have been quick to kind of brush it off and say, well, that was just kind of this. And I tend to look at it and say, no, wait a minute. He's a very calculating guy. If that happened, he probably meant that to happen.
The taking of Jerusalem in 1187 is especially interesting because of the failure of Saladin to massacre the Christian population. Mm-hmm. The pressure to massacre must have been immense. It's vengeance for what happened in 1099. Mm-hmm. It's Imad ad-Din actually has a statement about how Saladin says he's going to wash the streets, purify the streets of Jerusalem in the blood of Christians.
Saladin was portrayed by Imad ad-Din al-Isfahani is a fervent and bloodthirsty mujahid. Mm-hmm.
But when Saladin actually takes Jerusalem, he's moderate, generous. That's the Ernul version of it, but it also seems to be pretty much realistic. But he has to apologize for not massacring. And he explains in the letters that he sends out to the caliph and others that he took the city and he took it this way because of the threat to massacre all of the Muslim hostages in the city and pulling down the holy places.
He rescued the holy places. And again, here, and this is where in the book, I take a bit of a different stance here, because you mentioned Imad ad-Din Isfahani, yeah. Right? Crucial source. Yes, Saladin spares people. And I think he is very generous because he allows the Christians to ransom themselves. The ones who can't afford to, he even lets some of them go free. And the blame really for everybody who stays behind, you could argue, falls on such as the military religious orders who had more cash and could have ransomed more people if but they don't, right? So it's very easy to look at who is the bad guy here, right? But this Fahani does say afterwards that there were about 8,000 women left over, and Saladin gives them to his soldiers afterwards, and I would argue enables, not just enables, but allows a mass rape of the women in Jerusalem. And that is, again, I kind of mentioned these things that the people kind of pass over, and it's been kind of like, well, Isfahani is using colorful language, or he's in, I'm reading this, I'm like, wait a minute, right? If everything else about this is calculated, what is this giving the women over? Because the enslavement afterwards is routinely discussed. They are sold into the slave markets of Damascus, the ones who weren't able to be ransomed. What is this mass rape afterwards? Now, normally, this does happen in medieval sieges, typically when no quarter is given, right. Because the city has resisted, you've broken through the walls. But this is a city, this is quarter was given here. There was an agreement, there was a peaceful turnover of power once the fighting stopped, and yet you have this event. And so I always look at 1187, I say, it seems to me that the legend of Saladin has overwhelmed the reality in this instance. It is absolutely true. He spared these people's lives, right? He did enslave the rest, and his soldiers did, you know, enact this mass rape on the rest. So it's really sides of, you know, it's both sides of the coin.
I think that the reason why the legend of Saladin isn't touched by that, it's not in Ernul's account.
Right.
And that's because Ernul is really saying what Balian wants people to hear. What Balian wants people to hear is, Saladin is a reasonable man. You can deal with him. And if you're going to deal with him, you deal with him through me.
Yes.
We have this personal relationship.
Right.
And mass rape doesn't figure into that at all. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, Saladin becomes this figure that becomes the worthy adversary. Well, Richard, he becomes Richard's counterpart. I mean, the Western sources even want him to be baptized eventually.
Right. So yeah, I would agree that I think the West has always had a fascination with this guy. And, you know, it's odd on one sense. Wait a minute, this is the guy who destroyed the army at the Battle of Hattin. He just wiped them out.
Yeah.
He took the holy city, you know, he did all these things. He humiliated you on several levels, but there is this grudging respect nonetheless. And, you know, when I was working on the Siege of Acre, certainly the sources in the small moments, that you kind of can find to get a glimpse into his life, you see some of that. There's one where, there's an attack on the Crusader camp and a baby, one of the Franks' babies, is kidnapped. And, the mother comes to Saladin's tent and she's weeping and she says, please give me my baby back. He's innocent. And the Saladin, you know, Saladin is moved to tears and he takes pity on the woman and he gives the baby back. And you look at that and you say, aw, that's so nice. You know, and there's a lot of stories like that where you say, this is a guy who in many moments seems like a just ruler. And, you know, if you go forward in the Middle Ages and you start reading, Dante's Inferno, Saladin is in Inferno, but he's not in hell. He's hanging out in limbo. So even Dante saying, I don't know what to do with this guy, right? I mean, he's a Muslim. I can't put him in purgatory or heaven, but I don't want him to burn because he seems like a nice guy. So I'll kind of put him over here in limbo and he's just hanging out by himself.
At Kaiser Wilhelm in 1898, visits Damascus, looks at the shabby tomb that they've given to Saladin, and orders it to be rebuilt at his expense as a grand monument to this worthy adversary.
Yeah, and as I think it was Phillips who pointed out, was it in 1979, Jimmy Carter goes to Egypt and talks about Saladin in glowing words in a speech, in a foreign policy speech? You know, this man has superseded history in a sense. I mean, you can revise his reputation, the historical record all you want. I don't think you're ever going to change the legend that has somehow endured.
Okay, returning to 1099, Jerusalem has now been taken by the Crusaders. Jerusalem has now become the capital city for the new kingdom of Jerusalem.
How does it actually function that way? It's 60 miles inland. Most of the kingdom of Jerusalem is a coastal kingdom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it symbolic or is it a actual functioning capital?
You know, it does function in a sense, but I would separate. I would say it's a functioning capital for the rulers, but not for the people. The city is depopulated. There's no one there. Most of the Crusaders go home. About, we think, 3,000. There's that number again, 3,000, which is just, why always 3,000? 3,000 Crusaders stay in the east and distribute, you know, among, you know, there in Antioch and elsewhere in Edessa. So there's not a lot of people, and they've thrown out all the Muslims and the Jews. They've expelled them from the city. So they don't even have a market in Jerusalem in the early years. You can't even go and buy most of the staples that you need. You have to leave town to do your shopping, which must have been, you know, quite a hardship for the people living there. But from what we know is the kings do establish their first palace in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Later on, they build a new palace south of the Tower of David, which has not survived. And they do rule there. So administratively, it seems to have worked. If you read into, particularly as it picks up steam and people start coming back, you read about the 1130s, the 1140s, there, you know, the court is functioning. They're hearing legal complaints. The traders have returned to town and there, it does seem to be a functioning capital, despite it being so far away. As long as you can maintain that the trade route to Jaffa and patrol it with guys like the Templars, then you can kind of have this detached capital, in a sense, but they're almost forced into it. I don't know how after the crusade, how you establish your capital anywhere else. You have to do it where the Holy Sepulchre is. In fact, you know, as you know, that, you know, Godfrey, when he becomes caretaker of the city, he's not named king. He's this caretaker of the Holy Sepulchre, right? So, and then Baldwin gets the title of king later on. So yeah, it's really weird. You have a capital in a very small town in the middle of nowhere, which seems strange. But as you know, I live in Kansas, right? If you start looking around the Midwest and you say, well, where are the Midwest capitals of states? Right? You say, okay, Jefferson City, Missouri. Where? Jefferson City, right? Yeah, you start looking at some of these states and say, these are, you know, Springfield, Illinois. Well, okay, not Chicago, right? These very smaller towns.
New York, Albany.
Albany, New York, right.
Maryland, and Annapolis, not Baltimore.
Or I used to live in Delaware, right? Dover, not Wilmington. So it can work. It does seem strange to see something like this, but I think that the religious nature of the crusade, you have to. And we have to also remember that the other cities on the coast are in flux because, you know, the crusade stopped at many of them and did take some through treaty and through some fighting, but then the other ones have to be grabbed after the first crusade comes to an end. And the last one to fall, most famously, Ascalon, doesn't come into Christian control until 1153. So there is, if you want to rule on the coast, you have to say, well, where? It's still an unstable environment. Whereas in Jerusalem, you can say, look, it's fortified. It's off the trade routes. That does provide some security. And it's fully in our hands. So we can use it as a capital, and it remains that. After the Battle of Hattin, it really relocates to the city of Acre, where you read about Acre in Jonathan Rubin has done some great work on Acre in the 13th century. Boy, you walk through Acre today, even today, it is small and jammed in. There's not much real estate. You know, you can imagine you ran a kingdom out of this place. This is crazy. Whereas Jerusalem does give you space. It does give you, you know, freedom of action to some degree.
But as you pointed out, the capital had to be Jerusalem, the place where Christ was crucified and resurrected. Whatever its physical reality, Jerusalem, in the imagination of the medieval West, was the center of the world, as it was on that map in Daniel Callahan's office. The purpose of the First Crusade was to rescue the Holy Sepulchre. The rest of the Holy Land, at least in the minds of the First Crusaders, was an adjunct to the Holy City, which might be why the Latin Kingdom continued to be called the Kingdom of Jerusalem even after the physical loss of the city to Saladin. Okay, now that Jerusalem was once again in Christian hands, did its new rulers undertake a building program of churches and palaces to commemorate their victory?
There is building eventually. It takes some time because you simply don't have the money. You don't have the economics to do this. We have to remember this is a crusading army that, when it got to the city, only had enough wood to build one siege ladder.
And which wood that was left over from the old siege.
There's not a lot of materials, but over time they do build and they do refurbish to some degree. But it really takes time. If you're talking about what I would say sort of the most impressive building in the city, so you have, for example, the refurbishment of the Tower of David, that takes place in the 1160s during the reign of King Amalric I. They build that new palace. That's in the 1160s, right? You have some other things before that, Hospitaller Quarter, where the hospital is. And of course, it's not there anymore. There's a monument to it. The Hospitaller Quarter starts to get rebuilt in the 1130s and then again in the 1150s. So you see some building there. And then the one that really stuck in the craw of Saladin the most, there is a new monastery built north of the Dome of the Rock. Right. For the Augustinians. It's one of the first things Saladin tears down when he takes the city back, because the dome is turned into a church, and all the Islamic things are covered up. And of course they bring in the art and all these things that the Muslims don't care for in terms of images of people, you know, the saints and the martyrs. And then they build this monastery. So there is that, but you really have to look at it as it's a city that almost has to start from scratch, right? If you expel or massacre everyone living there and it's empty, well, first you have to get people back and you have to get an economy. So you have to allow a market and you have to allow traders in who are going to be Muslims, right, because that's who you're living in the middle of, and get those economics working, get donations from the West, and then you can start building. It seems to have taken a few decades to do.
So for practical economic reasons, the kings of Jerusalem reintroduced Muslim and Jewish traders into the city. That reminds me of Usama ibn Munqid's anecdote about how he was assaulted by a crusader fresh off the boat when he began to pray in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and how he was then rescued by some friendly Templars. Usama was a 12th century Arab poet, author, diplomat, and warrior whose memoir-like Book of Contemplation is a window on how the Muslim elite regarded
the Frankish settlers and crusaders. Here's the story as Usama told it. Quote, "Whenever I went to visit the holy sites in Jerusalem, I would go in and make my way up to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, beside which stood a wall mosque that the Franks had converted into a church. When I went into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where the Templars, who are my friends, were, they would clear out the little mosque so I could pray in it. One day, I went into the little mosque reciting the opening formula, God is great, and stood up in prayer. At this, one of the Franks rushed at me and grabbed me and turned my face towards the east, saying, pray like this. A group of Templars hurried towards him, took hold of the Frank, and took him away from me. I then returned to my prayers. The Frank, that very same one, took advantage of their inattention and returned, rushing upon me and turning my face to the east, saying, pray like this. So the Templars came in again, grabbed him, and threw him out. They apologized to me, saying, this man is a stranger, just arrived from the Frankish lands sometime in the past few days. He has never before seen anyone who did not pray towards the east. I think I prayed enough, I said, and left. I used to marvel at the devil, the change of his expression, the way he trembled, and what he must have made of seeing someone praying towards Mecca. And
the interesting thing about that story is that he's allowed to go in to pray.
Yes.
And that he's befriended by a couple of Templars
who apologize to Usama for the rude behavior of the recently arrived crusader. I love it that the crusader is upset that Usama is praying in the wrong direction. Not that he's a Muslim praying to his God, but that he is praying toward Mecca and not toward the east.
Right.
Praying in the wrong direction, which I love.
So there is a sort of accommodation of Muslims in Crusader Jerusalem that allows them to pray in their holy places?
There must have been. And we lack, if you're looking at, say, narrative sources, I don't know that we have a moment where you know, and then the king declared that this would be permitted, right? We have nothing like that. But we have his story, which is the, even before his story, we know that Muslims are in town because they are there, they are trading. You can presume that they're being, you know, taxed to death in right. the beginning, but then the taxes are taken away. Then they remove the tariff on them. So again, to need revenue, right? And then you get this story with Usama who read that story and some people have, you know, the Arabists who come in and they say, look, when it says Templars are his friends, the word they're using is not really, don't think about, you know, bosom friend, this sort of thing, right? But they knew each other. They're familiar with each other. And it is, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's extraordinary. It's not just that he's, you know, allowed to pray, but that he's allowed to pray in proximity to what is known as an Islamic holy space, right? And the person who's upset by it is not upset that he's praying. That he's, no. down, he's just saying you're facing the wrong way. Mecca's that way, right? And they apologize for him. So, you know, and the other response is, well, who is Usama, right? He's a diplomat. His dad runs Shaysar, so it's an ally of the kingdom. Of course, they're going to make accommodations to someone who's connected, right?
Finding crusaders for much of his life.
Oh, yeah, he has been. He talks about his greatest joys are going out and riding his horse and riding these people down, you know, and putting a spear through them.
And beheading the dead.
Yeah.
He heads his trophies.
Yeah, it's a strange story. And that was my take. I'm like, okay, so I have an elite doing this. All right, fine. What does that really tell you? What's really surprising when you get to the 1160s, you read the account of John of Würzburg, who has entire groups of Muslims, and they're praying in between Al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rock. And he even says, and you know, I had to look this up because I, you know, the last time I had been there, I had forgotten to look. He says they would gather by a sundial and they would pray there every day. And today there is a sundial there, and I found it's not the original. It's not the medieval sundial, but there's a tripartite arch that you walk through. You walk from Al-Aqsa north to the Dome of the Rock, and there's a sundial up there. And I just looked at it and said, oh, that's really cool. The same spot where they were praying by a sundial, there's another one there, and you can kind of stand in the place. And if you're talking about groups of Muslims, even if you were to say, well, maybe they're elites too. Okay, sure, maybe they're high-profile traders or whatnot, but entire groups of Muslims saying prayers together while Christians just let them do it, this is not the typical story that you hear. And I think it really speaks a lot to what crusade historians have spent a lot of time trying to argue, that there is a difference between a crusader
yes.
who arrives in the Holy Land and it's all new to him, and he's fighting for the Bible, and he's fighting the infidel, versus a Frank, who is a resident, who realizes, here, these are my neighbors, and I may not like them, and I may think that they're going to hell, but at the end of the day, we trade with each other, we have to deal with each other, and this is life, this is society. And there's all those accounts of people coming in and saying, you know, how can you possibly have a house next to a Muslim or next to a Jew? Because in the West, why would you ever do that? The Jews are being put into by the time you get to the reign of Henry II, we're putting the Jews into ghettos in Oxford. We're sending them to the outskirts of town. Why would you want to live right next to one? Different world, man. And those Templars are like, you don't understand how it goes around here.
Usama introduces his story with the observation that, quote, anyone who has recently arrived from the Frankish lands is rougher in character than those who have become acclimated and have frequented the company of Muslims, end quote. Over time, crusaders newly arrived from Europe increasingly thought something similar about the resident Franks of Outremer. Not that they were more civilized, but that they had gone soft. Worse, they had gone native. They wore native clothing, ate native delicacies, and, as you just pointed out, lived among Muslims and Jews.
Yes.
Did the number of pilgrimages to Jerusalem increase after the establishment of the city as the capital of a Christian kingdom?
Boy, you know, that's another great question. And my honest response is I don't know. Because having researched the earlier centuries, pilgrimage was very robust in the earlier centuries. So much so that people made multiple trips. One story, Fulk Nera, the Count of Anjou, made like 4 visits to Jerusalem, and every time he went, he stole stones from the Holy Sepulchre, right? You know, he's looting the grave of Jesus every time
They're called relics.
And, you can imagine you're kind of looking around, nobody's looking, stick a stone in my backpack, right? So there was robust pilgrimage before, so I don't know in terms of the numbers. I mean, certainly you read that there's this renewed interest and the pilgrim routes are open again and a lot of people are going. I just don't know numerically whether it's comparatively more or less than, say, the heyday of, say, the 10th century when everybody was interested in it. I honestly don't know. But you do get the sense that, yeah, now that it's open, people do want to come. And, you know, the Knights Hospitaller and Templars are there for a reason. Because people are coming, they are getting wounded, they do need protection, they do need military assistance. And I got to imagine you don't build a hospital with, what is it, I think 300 beds when they start off, when they expand it, if you don't have the business, right? So clearly there are people coming, but in terms of numbers, that's a great question. There's probably an expert on pilgrimage out there who can zero down on it.
Okay, so
between 1187 and 1229, Jerusalem was in the hands of Muslim rulers. Although I said that we would talk about Jerusalem in the 12th century, I have a question about Jerusalem in the 13th century. In 1228, the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II conducted what may be the weirdest crusade. He had taken a crusading vow upon his election as King of Germany in 1215, and then renewed that vow several times, always ignoring the Pope's plea that he fulfill his oath. Finally, in 1227, having married the heiress to the throne of Jerusalem, the 12-year-old Isabella, and having declared himself king of Jerusalem, ignoring the claims of the reigning king, Isabella's father, John of Brienne, Frederick finally set sail for Acre, only to turn back because of illness. This was the last straw for the Pope, who excommunicated him for his failure to fulfill his crusading vow. Frederick responded by going on crusade without attempting to get the excommunication lifted, which earned him a second excommunication, since it was not permitted for an excommunicate to go on crusade. Because Frederick arrived with only a small military force, and his status as an excommunicate made the kingdom's local nobility and the military orders, with the exception of the Teutonic Knights, reluctant to support him, Frederick had to broker a deal with the Ayyubid Sultan of Egypt, Al-Kamil, that returned Jerusalem, Nazareth, and Bethlehem to the Kingdom of Jerusalem. The Muslim holy places, the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, were to remain under Muslim control, and the city of Jerusalem was to remain unfortified. Everyone seems to have hated this treaty, and the Sixth Crusade was considered a failure, if not a travesty, despite Frederick having regained Jerusalem. John, my question to you, given its religious and symbolic significance, and we've been talking about that, how was Frederick able to regain Christian control of Jerusalem? Clearly, he didn't acquire it by force of arms. He threatened military action, but he did little more than march up and down the coast with an army too small to threaten Al-Kamil. Why is the Ayyubid Sultan willing to hand over to Frederick the third holiest place in Islam? Can you explain? It really puzzles me.
Yeah, I think there's a number of reasons for it, and I wish we had the exact ones. One of the things I point out is this agreement, this new Treaty of Jaffa, it's hammered out by Frederick II and Al-Kamil in private, mano a mano, just the two of them, no advisors, no bodyguards. When does this happen in world history where two political leaders meet by themselves, throw everyone out, and hammer out? So kind of interesting. In a way, we don't have it. Here's what we talked about, right? But here's what I would say. Al-Kamil had been dealing with crusaders for quite some time. He's there when the Fifth Crusade arrives and offers them Jerusalem at the time, although there's great question about whether he even had Jerusalem to give them in the first place.
Because Al-Kamil's more deadly enemies were his own family. He was almost overthrown in the Fifth Crusade because of a conspiracy by his younger brother. And during the Sixth Crusade, Frederick II's Crusade, he was engaged in a civil war with his cousin.
Yeah, because his cousin, is the Damascus branch of the Ayyubids, is running it. Jerusalem is defenseless at this time. The walls were torn down in 1219. By Al-Kamil's cousin, because the idea was, is if it's a city with no protection, it's going to be less appealing because you can grab it, and you won't be able to hold it. Right. And, you know, the remark I made in the book is like, this kind of reminds me of Nehemiah in the Old Testament, right? Where, you know, we have to go to Jerusalem. There's no walls. We're sitting ducks, right? Well, we have to rebuild the walls. Well, that's going to be a lot of work, right? So same thing here. So the idea is I'll make a 10-year truce, but it's not like anyone's going to stop me from getting the city back if I really want it, right? There's a little rebuilding that goes on of those walls, but not really after Frederick takes it. I think Al-Kamil knows that Frederick is there for the title, he's there for the glory, and that he's going to leave as soon as this deal is wrapped up, which he does. He doesn't spend much more time there. So you're not going to have a permanent presence of the Holy Roman Empire to worry about, right? He knows that Frederick's a divisive figure. Even the people in the East don't like him. The Templars can't stand the guy, right? I mean, he's got the support of the Teutonic Knights. Everybody else hates this guy. You know, when he sails away from Acre, supposedly the butchers run down to the shore and they throw pieces of meat at him as he's sailing away, right? The bishops out there, they don't like him. They denounce him. He's an excommunicate. So I think from Al-Kamil's perspective, you say, look, here's a guy who's here to do a job. I'm going to give him part of what he wants. I'm really not that concerned about it because we can get it back. He's not going to leave a massive garrison here. And we've got 10 years, frankly, to think about it. 10-year peace treaty.
And he negotiates that the Muslims will continue to control Muslim holy sites.
Right.
Which is amazing. Frederick II is the most atypical crusader.
It is an odd story. It's, you know, and yeah, you get the Temple Mount for Islam, which, as I point out, that's an agreement that is held to the present day. That exclusive Muslim prayer on the Temple Mount to the chagrin of a lot of other groups. You know, today and also in Frederick's own day, he's considered a sellout and a traitor to Christianity, you know, that he's allowed. But on the other hand, it seems strange. But if you think about what we've already talked about, right? Well, before Saladin, Muslims were praying on the Temple Mount, and they were allowed to do that by the Christian kings, right? And in the centuries before that, even if you go back to the very first Muslim capture of Jerusalem in 638, the deal worked out with the patriarch is Muslims get the mount because we don't want it anyway, and Christians get the sepulcher. So it's emblematic of kind of the story. I tried to calculate the years. I think I figured out something like in all of the history of Jerusalem, since the Muslims took the city, they've only been prohibited from praying on the Temple Mount. It's something like 19 years. It's just like the dominant story is Muslims prey on the Temple Mount. Frederick is just going back to an old deal. And it's interesting, after Frederick leaves, and there's once the truce lapses and there's more fighting and the city falls back, you have the Barons Crusades, where you reach more of the similar arrangements. You know, Muslims can be up there and we'll be content to be down here. And this is how we live, right?
So the story of medieval Jerusalem is not just a story of conquest and conflict, but it's also a story of accommodation.
Well, that would be my argument. You know, the book came out in 2022. I got to say, the reviews, I will admit, not everyone has agreed with me. And some have, you know, one of them, I think one of the most biting ones has been is what Hostler is talking about in terms of accommodation is just real politics. It's just, you know, if you have the power and this kind of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I get that, but I don't know. The more I look at it, I see a lot of just, you know what? This is life in the Near East. You can't make it a Christian theocracy. You can't make it a Christian-only territory. That's never going to happen. There are millions of Muslims. You have to reconcile yourself with that fact at the time. And I think Frederick is very, very pragmatic. I mean, this is one thing we know about him in general. He's a very pragmatic man. You know, super mundi, and you're always thinking about, you know, these scientific approaches, these sorts of things. I think he sees it as, look, I get the crown, I get the city, I make people happy, we can pray at the tomb of Jesus. That's all good, good stuff. Who cares about the Temple Mount at the end of the day? Yeah, we got churches there. I got it. Sure, but it's not like they're important to us. Let them have it. Let them have up there where the sun is hotter and they can suffer up there. We'll be downtown, you know, where the good place is. And so I think it is extraordinary. It always interests me when you have a member of another faith granting liberties to the other guy.
Right.
And that's what you have here, a Christian granting liberty to Muslims. I should point out, Al Kamil catches a lot of heat for this too. He is denounced just as bad as Frederick for making accommodations with the infidel and for sacrificing the rest of the city. There's a very popular preacher who writes a special sermon at the request of the caliph to denounce this guy, you know? And you know what they say about compromises, right? A good compromise is where both parties walk away a little upset.
Yeah.
This is a good compromise.
And
what's really nice is that it solved all the problems about Jerusalem, and Jerusalem has hardly been a problem ever since.
Oh, I wish that were true.
Well, on that note, we've come to the end of this episode. John, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. If our listeners wish to learn more about medieval Jerusalem, I recommend that they pick up your book, Jerusalem Falls, Seven Centuries of War and Peace, published by Yale University Press.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great to be on. It's been enjoyable.
If you're enjoying Tis But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction about the Middle Ages, please tell your friends and tell anyone you know who might be interested in things medieval. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, consider rating and reviewing it. I'm told that is the best way of spreading the good news. Until next time, bye for now.